Hey everyone, Justin Bell here with Drive to Win, presented by The Win Las Vegas and brought to you by Mobil 1 for the love of driving. Well, this show, episode 2 of our second season, we're going to talk all about the just past Bahrain Grand Prix. It's, well, is it a case of, oh no, here we go again? In a way it is. Max Verstappen stomped off into the lead and that was the end of the story as far as he's concerned. So much else was happening behind him, really some juicy stuff. And I don't know about you, but that sense of anticipation, that feeling of optimism that I'm just a viewer and I'm watching on, you know, on my TV, waiting to watch the start of the first race of the year, watching the pre-show, watching all the build-up. We talked about the testing last week, but all the storylines and everything, and then it distills itself down just into that moment when all goes calm for a driver. And I'll tell you what, there is an amazing moment as a driver when all that rubbish stops and all the distraction, all the noise, and it's just you behind the wheel of a car waiting for those five lights to go out. And remember, it's a random program that is an algorithm chooses, you know, between a very short period of time, obviously less than a second, for the lights to go out. And then it happens. All the speculation and everything is over. It's now down to reality. And I was on the edge of my seat and I got to admit there's a slight drop, a dip in my stomach as I saw the Red Bull with Max beat Charles Leclerc off the line. But that is not where the story ended. By the end of the race, of course, Sergio Perez was in second, 22 seconds behind. Carlos Sainz, he got third on the podium. Driver of the day, widely voted by everybody. He was only 2.6 seconds behind the Red Bull. And that in itself is a success story. His drive was sublime. He did some great overtaking. It was just, in every way, a great race from him. Charles Leclerc, I mean, he was four, so it was two Red Bulls, two Ferraris. And, you know, the pole sitter had some issues with the brake overheating. And obviously that was a huge distraction in the cockpit. But as it sort of unwound its way through the race, he managed to know how to drive it. And in all fairness, he wasn't that far behind his teammate, considering he had those issues. A little defenseless, a little bit vulnerable when it came to being overtaken. Because anytime there's an imbalance in the brakes, especially the front and one or the other will lock up, it's very hard to commit to the corners, especially in Formula One when they go in so hard. So it was just in every way, just a really enjoyable race in so many ways. Obviously, with Max right out the front, you could be thinking to yourself, the whole season's going to pan out that way. I don't think so. And my guest this week, which is Will Buxton, we had him on last season. He is such a voice of reason. He's right there. He's a historian, a passionate enthusiast, and a professional in our sport. He's an observer with an opinion and the experience to back it up. And he'll be sharing his stories with me, but I can't wait to find out what he thinks about it, because I don't think it's all over, really. The comments coming from the other team principals afterwards, it being a night race, there has that sort of post-party feel, and the paddock looked really alive. I really enjoyed the post-race show. And listening to people like Fred Vasseur say how much closer they were, I mean, by 50% to last year, that's all good stuff, isn't it? I mean, Mercedes-Benz bought lots of upgrades to their car. There's more to come. I know that obviously Lewis Hamilton's probably not overjoyed with his finishing position of sixth, but you know, when you think that they were so much closer than they were last year in this time, and George Russell was really driving so well. And again, remember last week we talked about George is the one that's staying in the team and Lewis is the one that is leaving to Ferrari. And I think from George Russell's point of view, there couldn't have been a more perfect start to the year just to subtly ingrain yourself and impress upon the team that you are the right guy to carry the mantle forward. McLaren, I mean, I really enjoyed watching Lando and Oscar do what he needed to do. They were so vibrant. They're such young, go-getting guys. And certainly in their post-race interviews, you could see the camaraderie, but the ruthlessness, the optimism. And I think you're going to find that McLaren, you know, this track has never suited them, Bahrain. So just watching the overtaking maneuvers within the parameters, within the opportunity that's presenting themselves, they really did a great job. So, you know, I'm just really looking forward to seeing how Zak Brown and the team build that up. Obviously, a lot of lovely tributes to our dear friend, my great friend, best friend, actually, Gilles de Ferran. He was such an integral part of McLaren last year, helping them reorganize, restructure. And the whole family were out there, Anna, Luke, and Angela, his wife, just to be at Bahrain. And David Coulthard organized it. And just to see the tributes on the car, it really meant a lot. So remember, Formula One is a family. It might be a $1 billion enterprise, but in the end, it's all about the people. How did you feel about the overtaking? That's what really got me on the edge of my seat. There were some moments, you know, when George Russell overtook Alonso and then Carlos on Charles more than once. Really great overtaking, which showed to me that there's a depth of energy, a depth of passion and dedication all the way down through the grid that mustn't be ignored or dismissed in the light of the Max Red Bull dominance at the front. And if Max was in the middle of the fight, you know, he'd be fighting just as hard. So I bet sometimes he wishes he was starting from the back of the grid so he could scrap with everyone on the way through. They're never going to allow him to do that. But, you know, in certain series, they invert the grid. But no, I think we're going to have to watch him do it from the front for a while. But it isn't all a disaster. Definitely the energy from disastrous, I mean, in terms of how the whole season's going to unfold. I definitely got the feeling that everybody there knows that they have more of a chance against the Red Bull in one way or another, certainly the top three teams. So let's just see. Keep the pressure on, guys, right? And that could be really good. It's the starts they got to get right, though. That's the frustrating thing. I said, you know, sitting there waiting for the lights to go out, what's going to happen? Who's going to get off the line better? And I actually can't wait to ask Will about how they do it, because in my day, foot clutch, here they have hand clutch. But as they go off, that is a moment that they really are alone. They are not relying on the support from the team. It's down to driver reaction time. And there was that great thing. Did you see it? It was a meme on Instagram where Pierre Gasly was doing a reaction test with some guy, some NFL linebacker or quarterback or whatever. I know nothing about American football. And it's where you drop the ball, tennis balls out of your hands, and then the other guy has to catch them. But it was funny because as Pierre dropped them, the footballer would pick them up, let's just say two and a half, three feet below where they were dropped, still got them every time. And then when he did it to Gasly, Gasly's reaction time, literally he picked them up 6 inches below his hands. That was the speed difference. It was a blinding example of how great the reaction times are of these guys. I'd probably just drop them. But in my day, maybe I'd have caught them. So I think there's a lot to look forward to. I just think they need to try and be a bit more dominant on the start. And if it was my choice, not my choice, but I bet every driver there knows, especially if you're on the front row, this is my one time to get Max behind you. And with the DRS opening, doesn't it so early, doesn't it change the strategy for everybody? And it was great. You could see that it, unfortunately, Max had pulled away more than a second, like a 1.2 as they went into the second lap. But there's going to be some fireworks when they start to work out how to get off the line. So it is a $1 billion sport. And rather unfortunately, we are totally distracted by what's going on with Christian Horner and the Red Bull situation. It doesn't seem to be going away. It just seems to be getting worse. And part of me wonders whether that's because we do live in this drive to survive goldfish bowl. Everybody should know everything. But do we deserve to know everything? I mean, this is my take on it. Christian Horner, remember, is arguably one of the best team principals in the history of Formula One. Under his stewardship, he has led the team to countless victories, countless championships. He's represented his sponsor in the best way possible. People have got rich along the way, won world championships, Max Verstappen included, and really Christian didn't put a foot wrong. However, what he is guilty of right now, and as a Brit, I've got to say this, I'm embarrassed. It's shocking. His texting, his sexting is, if it is true, what we're reading is so lame. And in the words of Paul Tracy, it's like reading the script to Downton Abbey. It's that bad. So if you are a pretty young American girl, do not judge us British people by that appalling literature that you're reading. Christian Horner is, while on track, he may be Red Bull in the dating game. He's more like Alpine. It's appalling. So I apologize for that. Don't judge us by that. So a bit of a lighthearted way to look at it, but really just keep focused on what he achieves as a top team principal and not get distracted from all the crap that's going on around him. But of course, everyone's getting involved. And Jos Verstappen is certainly one of those main ringleaders there. And apparently he's not even going to this weekend's race in Jeddah. He has been instructed by Horner to stay away, and his representative has been meeting with Horner and they're trying to sort it all out. But how is Max going to do without his dad being there? His dad has almost never missed a race. And if we throw our minds back, Michael Andretti, when he went to Formula One, it was so tough. And I don't think we can directly draw a line. But when Mario wasn't around, he didn't know how to get the best out of himself. So it'll be interesting. I do think Max is probably elevated enough not to get put off by that kind of thing, because that's what Jos has trained him for. But we'll see, right? The other teams, I know Toto and Zach are certainly hoping so. It does seem that in Formula One does have to be careful that the circus acts don't over sort of take and overshadow the main show. But I don't know, in today's world of communication, there seems to be so much scandal and gossip going around. Even the FIA president, Mohammed Ben Salam, is under investigation by his own ruling body for allegedly attempting to interfere with the result of the 2023 race, where Alonso was demoted by 10 seconds to fourth, but it got overturned. And then, you know, they had that moment where he served his penalty and the jack at the rear was touching the car, which you shouldn't do during a penalty, and they appealed it legitimately. They showed other cases with video where cars up and down the pit lane serving penalties had the same thing. So it got overturned, but apparently he made some influential calls to try and get it overturned. I mean, that's the stuff we don't need to have. And who's spending their time thinking about this? It's such a distraction. Formula One, it is the world's top form of motorsports. Let's not drive it off the rails and have it implode because of all the rubbish that happens around the side. Well, I'm going to spend most of the time talking about the race with Will, so I won't spend much longer on this. But the Wynn Las Vegas and the Heineken Silver Grand Prix of Las Vegas. Remember, last year, this was the place to be. It was definitely an eye-opener for everyone involved, from the official welcome party and the red carpet event. And then we had that amazing RM Sotheby's official auction, which was taking place in the Awakenings Theatre. Auctioneer dropping down from the ceiling, all the floodlights, old cars coming out to the middle, and Lewis Hamilton's, one of his championship-winning cars, Formula One cars, right there selling for a record $18-plus million. Hairs on my neck are standing up now. It was so cool to see. We had the Netflix Cup out there, race-themed pop-up experiences, Lewis Hamilton doing a pop-up with his clothing brand. It was outrageous, and this year promises to be absolutely the same and even a lot better, especially now everybody in Las Vegas knows how to rev it up. So whenever you're planning your next trip to Las Vegas, remember, come to the Wynn Las Vegas, because this is the motorsport and automotive resort in Las Vegas and definitely the place you want to see what's going on. So information on the packages for Ultimate Race Week will be coming up right here very soon. You'll be amongst the first to hear what the Wynn Las Vegas has in store for you. Well, our guest on this show is Will Buxton, definitely one of my favorite guys, personalities in Formula One. He is an enthusiast, passionate about the sport. He's been around for years, was one of the key figures in Drive to Survive. If you've been watching the latest season, he really narrates the storylines through every episode. And he has a new book coming out called Grand Prix, An Illustrated History of Formula One. Fresh off the airplane from Bahrain. Will, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, good, mate. Good. Tired. Happy to be home. Sad, actually, not to be in Saudi Arabia. It feels so odd when you get all hyped and psyched for the start of the season. You do testing. But such is the calendar this year. You know, 24 races. I'm down to do 16. So Saudi was one that I was always due to be missing. But No, great to be back. Are we allowed to say Happy New Year?
Yeah, we are happy. We should. Yeah,
I'd
we
like
should
to
say
Happy New Year.
Ah, thank you. Happy New Year to you too.
Feels mad.
It's March, but I've always wondered that. At what point is that break point that you no longer say Happy New Year? Do you find that during January you're sort of like, it's the 21st. I should probably stop. But anyway, happy Happy New Season.
Happy New Season.
Happy New Season, mate.
So, yeah, what a start to the season.
What a start. I mean, I want to kick it off. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for your beautiful tribute to our great, great friend, Gilles de Ferran. I mean, it was, you know, he was my best mate. And I've been devastated in every way. And just to see you with your T-shirt on, so good. And of course, Angela, Luke and Anna were there. I mean, tell us a bit about that. That's really, it was just so good to see you doing that.
Well, you know, I love Gilles. And I mean, you know what that's like. Yeah. It's it was difficult not to. In fact, I don't think I've ever met anybody who didn't completely fall in love with that man the second that they met him. He was just kind, thoughtful, such a family man. Just, you know, you'd only ever be speaking about racing for the shortest amount of time because he'd just flip it straight around to talking about his family all the time, which was, that was Gilles. But, you know, anyone who ever had the joy of watching him race, he was just, and he was a magician, you know, he was just an absolute magician on the track. Yeah. And then, you know, in recent years, I think, the quiet role that he was playing at McLaren, whether it was in Formula One, over in IndyCar, or coming back to F1 again, you look at the turnaround in McLaren last year, and so few people realize the role that Gilles played in that turnaround last year. And the last conversation that I had with him at the end of last year was, we were really sort of talking about that and how quietly proud he was of it, because he wasn't a big boastful character. No. He was always so understated in everything he'd ever done and everything he'd ever achieved. And yeah, it was just, I mean, you know, mate, just an absolutely beautiful soul ripped from this world painfully too soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's wonderful you did that. I love the tributes on the McLaren cars. Anna and Luke posted their pictures with it. I mean, just, you know, with his name on it, and it's great. He never sought fame, actually, at all. And I said that at his little funeral. He didn't. It wasn't his thing, you know. He did, his actions showed on the track. So, you know, and as a man. Oh. So a great, great guy. So thank you. Thank you very much for doing that.
Oh, mate. Yeah, of course. Of course. I saw Anna on race morning, which was lovely. Mate.
And she was DJing and doing that. She's with Diplo.
Yeah,
I was like,
she was sharing it with Diplo. She was loving it. Absolutely going for it. And yeah, she's amazing.
And
she's
the great amazing. Thing is, thankfully for us, she dances better than Gilles ever did. So that's, if we'd seen him shaking his fat Brazilian ass on the grid, it would have been awful. Well, let's move on. I actually asked Michael Potts, you know, Michael, great photographer. He was my guest last week because I wanted someone that was there on the ground. But I'm going to ask you the same question. There's that sense of first day at school, new optimism. Everybody believes within reason they were in with a shout. I imagine it was like a frequency change on a radio when Max started going fast, right? It must have just been oh God. Tell us what that was like for you.
Kind of, but kind of not. So here's the thing. I love testing. Testing is my first day of school, and testing is probably my favorite time of the whole season because it's like, it's Christmas Day. It's open the presents, see what you've got, and start playing with your toys. And I love preseason testing for that, you know, and it's only 3 days. So no one ever gets everything figured out, not even the top teams, and particularly when you get a situation like Red Bull and Mercedes, who had completely changed their concepts this year, they're never going to get as far down the road as they want to in an ideal world. So that was really fascinating to be entering the race weekend with so many completely different concepts, and everyone had a real ebb and flow to their testing. So Alpine for the first 2 days were all smiles. And so, you know, this is good. You know, everything's going to plan. Everything's great. Everything's where we want it to be. And then on day three, just, you know, didn't know what to do with themselves. And it turned out that, you know, we thought they might be sixth, seventh And then you start dialing into it and talking to people at the team. And by the time we got back for the race, it was like, actually, these guys are last. At best, they're going to be ninth. And some teams were looking better than we thought, but Red Bull was still up at the top. But everything we saw up to that point suggested the gap might be a bit less, or that there would be the opportunity for other teams to fight. And as it turned out, I think a couple of teams actually spooked themselves out of being more in the fight than they could have been. And Red Bull's tire advantage, in that they saved a set of softs, so they were able to run soft, hard, soft with the two stop, and everyone else did soft, hard, hard. That kind of skewed the picture. And I don't think it's as bad as everyone's making out. I don't think it's the whole, oh God, they're going to win every race. I genuinely don't think that it's that bad. I think a lot happened to sway us towards that slightly negative view. You know, Ferrari sent Charles out for a second run in Q1. And as he was leaving the pits, he said, this is a mistake. And came straight in and aborted the lap. And so then had, you know, one of his sets of softs was used for Q3. Without that, he'd have had two decent runs on new softs and might have challenged Max for the pole, because his Q2 time was better than his Q3 time. His Q2 time would have taken pole away from Max. So, you know, over one lap, it's looking much better between Ferrari and Red Bull than we thought. And you look at the end of last season and it was close between them. So, you know, I think that's good. I think that, as I said, the tire offset gave a different picture than we'd had at the start of the race. But, you know, the Ferraris can keep up with Checo.
Well, I mean, that's the big news, right? I mean, it's the wrong Red Bull, but boy, oh boy, they couldn't do that last year. And that's what I wanted to sort of ask you. Starting quite literally at the start, especially with the DRS being available. I'm glad you said that, because I like that. Especially
it's been such a long time coming.
Yeah, you know? and sometimes they make rule changes that really are for the better, and that is one of them, right? So
because why allow the guy 2-3 laps to stretch his legs?
Yeah,
just have it go straight away.
So now Will, you're my driver. You're Charlie, right, on the front row, and I'm there, and I'm going, all right. So we know he's going to be fast. You've got one thing to do. Get off the freaking start line ahead of him. You, whatever it takes, you need to beat him to turn one. That will totally set back his strategy. Now, you know he's probably going to go by, but then you've got him within DRS range. Then he's not doing his thing. I watched that, the Red Bull get off. You know how they just suddenly pull ahead and you got that second and you go, that's it. He's beating him to the first corner. Even with that little twitch he had, I would say to you as the team owner, I'd be like, God, Will, why didn't you get him into the first corner? Can you just run us through, because you have a lot more insight. What do the drivers have to go through? What? Cut the first corner. Yeah.
Just cut the first corner.
Yeah, that would be good. What do they actually have to do in the car on the line? What are they? Because I remember sitting there, my little, you know, whatever racing I did, standing starts, basically rev counter, gear stick, and then we go. I love standing starts. What do they have to do? Hand clutch. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so essentially when they get into their grid box, they have to put the car into first gear and do all of your selections to make sure that it's in race start mode. Essentially, like, yeah, back in the old days when you turn on your computer console and you'd put the cheat code in, you know, before it start, A B up down left right X Y whatever, you know, get it into its start mode. But this is the only time when the hand operated clutch comes in, because you still have to hold it on the clutch, which is why Lewis, you often see him with his hand over the top of the.
That's why, because I'm thinking, God, boy, he looks like he's driving through the hood. He's got his fingers over the top.
He's holding his. He feels he's got a better feel over the top like that. Mm. So you hold it on the revs, on the clutch, like you would in a road car with your feet, but you've got a hand operated clutch, and that's it. That's the only time the clutch comes into play, is at the start of the race, and then it's just your reaction times and getting minimal wheel spin, getting the best possible launch you can, and then trying not to shunt into someone on the way down into turn one, a la Hülkenberg, who appeared to just break way, way too late and undid all of that great work that he'd done up to that point, which is such a shame for him and for my fantasy team.
You mentioned that. That's funny.
I had him pinned. Anyway, and we know, you can't win a Grand Prix at the first corner, but you sure as hell can lose one. And And maybe the fact that they know that DRS is now enabled after a lap stopped people from maybe putting on more of the moves or taking more chances on that run down to turn one, because they knew that come the end of lap one, they'd have the opportunity, they'd have the ability to overtake, whereas before it would have taken them, you know, three, four laps to have got to that point. So perhaps that was playing in their minds a little bit. And also, you're always going to have a little bit of rustiness coming out of the winter and 2 months of not racing. So, well, 3 months nearly of not racing. So the first race, first corner is always tentative, but I think this year a little bit more tentative.
But after that point,
we talk about the Ferraris being able to take the fight to Red Bull over the course of the Grand Prix. The pace of George Russell and that Mercedes in those early laps on those soft tires was absolutely scintillating as well. And had he been able to make the moves a little bit earlier and get on up, could he have, you know, been able to start making inroads into Verstappen? I don't think we'll know for sure, because unfortunately both he and Lewis ended up having power unit issues during the Grand Prix, which cut them back. So we never saw everything out of Mercedes in this race either. You know, it wasn't just getting onto the hard tire. They were struggling with power unit issues and lifting and coasting throughout the Grand Prix. I don't think we've seen everything yet, mate.
Yeah.
You know, yes, Max Verstappen won and got the perfect, you know, Grand Chelem of pole and led every lap and got the fastest lap and, you know, everything else. But, and it's a huge but, you know, I don't think we've seen everything from Ferrari. I don't think we've seen everything from Mercedes just yet. And that gives me a lot of hope.
I think you're approaching it in the right way. That hope thing is correct, because we know that people respond differently under pressure. And if you're able to control everything without pressure, I mean, I really honestly think, as far as Max was concerned, he probably gets out and says to his dad, "That was pretty bloody easy." You know, he never said that to the media. He's like, "That was pretty much a stroll in the park." Especially at the end of the last year, I think that's how he felt. But if we can force him into that moment where, you know, the pit stops are a little more pressure on their guys, you know, you have to beat the next guy, you know, have to come out the pit lane right, I think you're going to start to see, you might start to see some unforced errors, which we have not seen at all. And that's what everyone needs.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, Max loves a fight. Max loves to race. You know, he's a true racer. And as you say, if he's getting out of the car going, "Oh, Dad, that was a bit too easy." You know, we hear Max saying, "Oh, you know, I won't be in Formula One forever. I want to go and do other things." And if it comes to him too easily, no wonder he might want to go and do other things. If he has to fight for it, if he has to battle for it, I'm sure that love, that satisfaction will only grow with that. And you know, look, you know, you're sitting there in Vegas. I look back a couple of months to that brilliant week we spent out there.
Yeah.
And that brilliant race that we ended up having, because it was a proper fight.
Yeah.
And Ferrari were in that fight.
Yeah.
And Charles came so close. You know, if we get that this year, I'm well up for that because I think that was a brilliant group. It was one of my favorite Grand Prix of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to bring that up
with Monza and Singapore. And
yeah, I was going to bring that up later.
It was brilliant.
Because I don't want to get back to the race a sec. But if I'm sure the FIA, and I mean, Formula One, they sit there and they go, "So why was that race so good?" It's just that, you know, you know some tracks are crap and they don't make for good racing. But Vegas, once we got going, everyone walked away going, "Oh, that was so good. The racing was so good." At that time of the season, why do you think it was? The track? The moment in the series?
There was a combination of factors. Number one, really reduced practice time. Very little data on the track. And when they got there, they realized the data they did have on the track didn't necessarily match up to real life. Cool conditions, slippery asphalt, tires that were a bit too hard and a bit too cold, ultimately led to one of those kind of perfect storms.
Yeah.
We were having a chat after the Grand Prix on Sunday, like, you know, what would we do if we were emperor for a day, what would we do? And one of the ideas was you totally ban car to pits or car to factory telemetry once the lights go out. Just ban it. None. So you got to just go on instinct and feeling, and you get your timing, sure. But, you know, can't tell Mercedes to lift and coast. If the engine's going to go bang, you got no warning. It's just going to go bang. And then you just go. That was one idea. But those races where, you know, this, and one of the reasons that a lot of people, you know, think that the sprint weekend has merit is because you have so much less data acquisition with one practice session and then straight into a qualifying session. You know, there's no time to delve so deeply into things that by the time the lights go out, it's a foregone conclusion. And so you do get these mixed up grids or these mixed up races or people trying to fight their way through. I'm all for that because it's just, you know, it's absolutely astonishing that we've reached this point in Formula One where I think the first time in history you've had two no DNF races on the bounce, like everyone finished. So Abu Dhabi end of last year and Bahrain start of this year. Reliability is incredible. And they need it to be, you know, in the midst of a budget cap. But these are prototypes. And this was their first race. And every single one of them finished. Yeah. It's truly astonishing. And then factor in, again, I'm, you know, take it from reliability, take it into pace, take it to the potential of what this year might be. Q1, Bahrain Grand Prix, every single driver within a second. 10 brand new prototype cars. And they're within a second. Oh, that was incredible.
So many different philosophies on the design, engineering approach, yet all within reason. It shows how I always think this, that you have the same amount of data when you're building a road car and the same amount of production techniques and everything. And in the end, the figures go in and pretty similar results have to come out within the brilliance, without the brilliance of the individual engineers.
And Alpine were back at the grid a second off the pace. And now their tech director and head of aero have gone. And you think, they're a second off the pace. Like, that's it.
It's, I mean, they'd have been happy with that their last year.
How competitive it is.
There was so much talk. All your colleagues, everyone, every podcast, everyone. And like, I mean, Alpine seemed to be, you know, they're obviously, they're down and being trodden on a bit by everybody, just in disbelief that they can be that bad. How are they? I mean, kind of a bit topsy turvy here. We're talking about them, but how do they drive themselves out of this? I mean, they got rid of the two top guys. With that amount of money, a friend of mine said this week, they still have sponsors, even though they're at the back, right? People are paying for this. So how does this pan out?
I don't know, mate. I mean, you and I, we've been in this game a long time. It feels like we've seen it all before. It's a very Renault thing to do, isn't it? You know, they've always been brilliant as an engine manufacturer, but when they come in and try to do the race team by themselves, there's so much bureaucracy and that weight, that anchor around the team's neck just drags it down every single time. And then the parent company thinks better of it and says, no, this isn't working. This is terrible for the share price. We need to pull out and go back to just being an engine manufacturer again. And it happens every single time. And, you know, you look at where they've gone, which was a team that was just outside being in the top three, you know, fourth place in the world championship, brilliant with their upgrade packages, brilliant with their developments, just consistently on it. And then through last year, these internal political wranglings, Rossi goes, Otmar inexplicably gets fired, Bat leaves as well. And then, you know, they put in an interim solution. And then they've flown into this year and dropped even further off. How do they pull this back? This is supposed to be, you know, Bruno Famine and Alpine's grand plan. I don't understand what the plan is.
And they've lost some of the top drivers through their fingers. I mean,
yeah,
Piastri,
exactly.
I mean,
they just... Piastri, they lost Alonso, and yeah, and you got Ocon and Gasly, both of them are, you know, out of contract at the end of the year. They're both Grand Prix winners.
Yeah.
They're not going to want to hang around.
No, God.
So it's a massive question mark, but you and I, we've seen this.
Yeah.
We've seen this story played out time and time again. You know, it's...
It'll work, you know, more to come. The thing is maybe at the back they can get on and try and fix their problems out of the spotlight because there's so much happening.
I feel it's so awkward though, you know, because you travel the world with these teams and you never want anyone to come in last place.
No.
Because the work that goes on, you know, from the factory floor to the garage you know, in every single team is absolutely phenomenal, but someone has to come last. And you feel awful having to stand in front of the garage and tell the bad news that these guys are not going to have a very easy year. And it's so, so tough, because for the boys and girls in the garage, they've got to make do with what, you know, with what they're given. And they've got to try and turn this, in Alpine's case, massively heavy, aerodynamically inefficient car into something that compete with the Red Bull,
yeah,
which is, you know, lightning on wheels. And it's so, so hard. And I'd never want anyone to think that when we talk about a team doing badly and a team being in a mess and a sorry state, it has nothing to do
with people,
with the boys and the girls, no, in the factories and in the garage, because, you know, it's out of their hands, and they're doing mm-hmm. absolutely everything they can. And you know that, and you respect that, but you sort of look at the higher ups and what's going on, and the Machiavellian, or, you know, attempted Machiavellian politics that was going on last year. And it's just, it's a mess, and they've shot themselves in the foot. They've taken a brilliant team that was on the cusp of being able to go and fight for the top three. And they've dashed it into a million pieces.
Oh God. And at great expense. I mean, great expense. Well, tell you what, on a brighter note, watching that race, I like what just so our viewers don't sit there and want to, you know, dunk their head in the bathtub three times and come up twice. The overtaking in the race, I got to say, I was like, God, I love the fight in these young guys. I mean, George pulled off some great moves. Lando did. I mean, you saw so much overtaking throughout the, you know, when the moment came, you remember these guys have got so much fight in them, Will.
Yeah.
And every position does count. And that is what gave me hope, if you like. You know, I know we keep saying the best of the rest, but it is a very, very competitive field. And that gap between each of them, you must have been thinking, wow, we do have a race on our hands here. We could have a really, last year's championship was very vibrant. This one could be even closer.
Yeah, and even if Max runs away at the front, you know, cameras aren't going to follow him. Let's watch the rest.
Yeah.
Carlos Sainz was phenomenal. Instinctive, impulsive, beautiful overtaking moves. You know, this is a guy who's just been told he's getting replaced in Ferrari for next year. He's on the open market. Over half of the grid are on the open market for next year. Every single race is another line on their CV. Mm. It's another opportunity to impress, to stake their claim for a seat in the sport. Because let's be honest, not every one of these guys is going to stay in the sport next year. You know, you look at the likes of a Valtteri Bottas, you know, Joe Guan Yu, Logan Sargeant, you know, maybe even one or even both of the Alpine boys, you know, they might not make it onto the grid next year. And they've got to be aware of that. Their fan base has got to be aware of that. Every single race counts. Every single race is an opportunity for them to prove their value, prove their worth, prove that they should be around in 2025. And boy, Carlos just, you know, he added another star against his name. Just a brilliant drive. And he's going to be top of so many shopping lists.
I really enjoyed that sight of, I think the Ferraris are so beautiful. I hope you do. In person, they must look so good. Because I love the Le Mans sports car livery. You know, that's where they sort of introduce that double line. You know, it just looks so good down the side of the car.
Beautiful.
But when he went down the inside, launched it from about, you know, before the brake zone, all the way down the inside into turn one there, and they're wheel by wheel, I thought there was and the commentators really in DC said it very well, because I listened to it on the app mainly, and watch it on the app. And as he went around the inside, you could tell there was two pro drivers with respect, both fighting inches, millimeters away from each other's wheel. And you could tell Carlos, he's got a point to make, and he is not going to be a lame duck, is he?
No. And as you said, it was, you couldn't fit a cigarette paper between them. It was huge respect between them both. Fred Vasseur, I'm sure, had a bit of a squeaky bum time sitting on the pit wall, as he did at Monza last year. But you love to see it. Absolutely love to see that kind of battling, love to see that kind of fighting. And if we get that you know, through them, between them throughout the year, then I'm going to be loving it, as I think everybody else will. But Carlos has got a point to make. You know, he wants to make the point to Ferrari, you know, you dropped the wrong guy, or you shouldn't have dropped me in the first place. And to every other team to say, you know, I'm the guy you need. I'm the guy you want. And, you know, that team includes Mercedes right now. It includes every single team out there. It includes Red Bull. It includes every team to say, you know, I'm the guy you want in your car next year. And these are the reasons why. And he is, I was talking to Jolyon Palmer about it. And Jolyon reckons right now that, you know, Carlos is probably one of the best, if not, I think Jolyon said he thought he was the best overtaker in the sport.
Wow.
Because he's just instinctive and just takes his moment, doesn't dilly-dally, doesn't think about it, just weighs it up, straight in, no two laps about it, just straight in, makes the move, makes it stick, and off he goes. And
a bit more old school.
Yeah,
mega.
Yeah.
It's a bit more old school. Like, I do feel some of them are burdened by the, not politics when you're behind the wheel, but the technology, the strategy, the tire deck. In the old days, people just went by every time, every opportunity they got. And I feel Carlos does that. I think that's his, you know, that's his style. And that's very, I don't know, it's very masculine. You know, he just gets on with it.
Just doesn't overthink it. Yeah. You know, he just gets on with it, gets the job done. And look, when we're talking about Max, it's another really interesting facet. And it's something we were discussing throughout the weekend is almost this defeatist nature that exists amongst some of the drivers in the sport that, you know, you come into the weekend and they almost feel they're beaten before they even begin, or they feel they're beaten before they begin. And they've got to snap themselves out of it, because if they've got an opportunity this year, they've got a car that can compete, but you're coming into a weekend thinking, well, I can't compete with Red Bull and I can't compete with Max. Well, you're done, you know? And you've got to snap out of that and get into this mindset of we can compete, we can fight. Because if they can, and if they do have the car, you've got to go in with the right mindset. And I think the one good thing we do have this year, as I said, is, you know, over half the grid are fighting for their careers. So they're going to have to approach the races with an, you know, can-do attitude rather than a defeatist, oh, we're just turning up to get beaten.
I love the fact you said that, because at the end of last year, which Grand Prix was it where Ferrari front row, Red Bull, Max drove straight through the middle of them. And I'm going, close the bloody door. What the hell? And even Lando afterwards said, well, I knew he was going to go by at some point. So I was
right?
Like, no, no, no. Have you ever watched a NASCAR? I tell you, I did the Watkins Glen Road race. These guys will overtake you in the pit lane. They will overtake you into a hairpin. Yeah. They'll overtake you while you're trying to just do... They overtake you, even if they know you're going by the next moment. They do not stop overtaking. It's chaos. And it takes, as a road race, you're a bit like, oh, I should wait my moment. No, they just go every freaking moment. And and do that and to Max. Slam him.
I mean, you know, Max has won races from, you know, 14th on the grid, 18th, you know, wherever. It seems wherever he starts a Grand Prix, he wins. But if you don't put up the fight because you believe he's got a faster car, so he's just going to get past you in the long run, then... You know, you're just kind of waving him through.
Yeah.
And no one wants this. No one wants, you know.
Nah, we don't want that.
Again, would you start the race winner from last place every Grand Prix if it meant you'd get an exciting race? Well, if they're just going to wave him through, then no. Yeah. So you just got to get that mindset. And I think it's too early in the season to have that mindset of they're unbeatable. Yeah. And even they are admitting, look, you know, we got lucky with the tire strategy, with bits and bobs, you know, Mercedes having to turn down their engines and everything else. Even Red Bull acknowledge that on the basis of what they've seen and the basis of what they know about their car, there are going to be tracks that won't suit them this year. There are going to be instances like Singapore last year where they're just not on it, and it will happen far more frequently than it did last year. Mm. So I think there is reason to be optimistic and reason for every driver, particularly in those top teams, to turn up to the races, not with the defeatist attitude of, well, we're fighting for second, but with the attitude of, you know, if we get everything right, there's every reason to think we can take it.
So based on what we saw this weekend, who will be the first driver to win other than Max?
On the basis of what we saw this weekend, Carlos, he was absolutely mega. And you know, the Ferraris can fight over one lap in the Grand Prix. They look good. Like, they look really good. So happy, optimistic for Ferrari. They seem to have got on top of some of their tire woes from last year. And a race pace looked really, really impressive. So that's great. Mercedes have a lot to learn about their new car, but at the same time, I thought looked really, really good. They will be concerned about the fact that They had those power unit issues in the Grand Prix. Lando had to change his battery and his ECU over the weekend, and both Williams had flashing messages up on their steering wheels all the way through the Grand Prix saying that the car was overheating. So the engine department over at Mercedes might have a few headaches and might be scratching their temples a little bit after Bahrain. But if they can get that in hand and under control, and they can get to grips with this concept of car, I think Mercedes can be up there. For me, it's those three teams at the moment. McLaren and Aston Martin a little bit behind them. But they're your top five.
Watching the race evolve as well, obviously, there's always good races throughout the race, you know, throughout the field. And I know you know, we know that, like you said, about the teams are working as hard. It's not just about, you know, right at the sharp end. Two people I want to ask about. Perez obviously finished second. That is his job. Rumor was that he's, you know, he had a sort of slightly different, the vibe was that a slightly different approach this year. Maybe he's realized that his job is, you know, he's never going to be a world champion. He's not going to beat his teammate. So he just has to be the best number two, you know, a la Eddie Irvine-esque. You know, let's just be the best we can. Obviously, he's qualifying. He makes mistakes still, but he pulls his way back through. He should rightfully be second in every race. But as you say, with Carlos right there, do you think they rue keeping on Sergio? I mean, there were so many other choices. I mean, really? Or do you just let Max just do what he does and you don't need a superstar in number two?
I think it's very difficult to be Max's teammate. And particularly to put someone alongside Max who will want to fight for the world championship. I think that's very, very difficult, because when they come up against him and realize that they can't beat him, then their shoulders slump and they tail off. I don't think Checo would ever be happy with his lot as a number two. But as you say, there's nothing wrong with being a Rubens Barrichello.
Yeah.
And being roundly loved around the world, you know, never having, you know, realistically had a shot at the world championship because he was Michael's teammate. There's nothing wrong with that. It's interesting, you know, because I was looking at Checo saying he had a new philosophy for this year and a new way of approaching it, but I'd never quite thought of it in those defeatist terms of, well, I'm never going to be world champion, so I'm just going to actually enjoy my time and make the most of it rather than stressing myself out and doing myself out of a job. Maybe I should just enjoy driving the fastest Formula One car, you know, on
ever
the
built.
Yeah, and take my chances, and you know, if he has a bad day, then I go and win, you know, because I could be in a far worse car than I am, so I'll just take this. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Maybe it's taken the burden off his shoulders, and he's like, all right, I'm just going to be bloody good in number two. That's it, you know.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I don't know. I think Checo's brilliant.
Yeah,
but you know, there is a lot. We can't say much, but there is a lot going on within that team at the moment. And so it's really impossible at the moment to say the considerations that we had last year and even coming into this year might change, you know, as the year goes on, because we were looking at, you know, does Checo have a secured seat? You know, might he get replaced after a number of races? What's going on at RB? Is Yuki Tsunoda's seat safe? Is Daniel Ricciardo's seat safe? What about Liam Lawson? And all of that, and the power politics and the interplay of the drivers throughout the team. And, you know, it could all look very, very different in a few months' time. So we don't really know what's going to happen there. But I think Checo's a phenomenal driver. You know, he's a Grand Prix race winner. He's a great guy. He's a brilliant driver. And he's no idiot. And he is no slouch. Max is just doing something unbelievable, clearly, with that car, because, you know, the Ferraris can compete with Checo. They just couldn't compete with Max. And as I said, Checo's not an idiot.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant racing driver. Max is just, as Toto said on Saturday evening, he's in another galaxy.
I love that. I know, I wrote that down. Before we get to talk about the 1,000-pound hairy, muscular gorilla standing in the corner of the room that no one wants to talk about, but we all are at Red Bull, let's talk about RB. Danny Rick Daniel, he's, I mean, a bit of a mixed race in a way. He does need to, he needs to exert and impress. I think if you're getting talked about as potentially that number two seat at Red Bull, you've really got to shine like a meteor, yeah, haven't you, in the RB team? And is that the job he's got to do this year? Because the race was, I mean, he had good moments in it. I guess the one we got talked about was on the slowdown lap with Yuki.
Yeah.
What do you think about that call? I mean, I'm asking so many questions, but literally my mind's gone. I mean,
yeah.
First of all, that let him pass. What the hell? I mean, I don't blame Yuki for going, what?
If we go back, I think Daniel underperformed in qualifying and he knew that he had and didn't find that comfort level in the car that he was expecting. Yuki made changes from Thursday into Friday, say from practice into quali, because you get confused about the days, and felt much better in the car for qualifying and it was actually having a pretty tidy race. I think they got their strategy completely wrong to find themselves behind Magnussen, who again, he had a great day. I thought Haas had a good weekend overall. Mm. RB didn't play it strategically very well. And then just as Yuki was trying to shape up Magnussen, here comes Daniel on the soft tires and Yuki refused to let him go. Now, if in that moment, they will have talked about it in the briefing before the race. They would know what strategy they were on. And if it had come to this, all the drivers know, if team says, get out of the way, let your teammate have a go, you do it. Because Daniel's on the softer tire. And the time that he lost, the time that he wasted behind Yuki, the tire was going off all the time. So he didn't have as much bite in it to have a go at Kev as he would have wanted. And so then he tails back and the move never happens. And there you go. And ultimately, it was only for a P12.
Yeah.
But you never know if somebody at the front's going to, you know, take themselves out or take somebody else out. And then a couple of places move you up and you're in the points. So you never know. You never know. I think Yuki's refusal to move was short-sighted. His reaction after the flag was just boneheaded and stupid, and the way that he spoke to the team was not great for somebody who is massively under the microscope this year and trying to hang on to his job. I have a feeling that all those guys within that RB team have been put on notice and told, if you don't match up to what our expectations are of you, then Liam Lawson will be in and we will absolutely have no issue with moving you guys around throughout the year. And when you look at the way that, you know, why act like that at the first Grand Prix of the year unless you're feeling the pressure? And why are you feeling the pressure in the first race of the year unless you know your job's on the line? So all of that added up to me to say, yeah, these guys, you know, are definitely feeling that, and Liam is just waiting to pounce on that opportunity. And Yuki's done himself zero favors.
Yeah,
absolutely. Whether you agree with it or not, you go along with it, you play it dutifully, and then at the end of the race, you take to them and go, guys, that was dumb. Next time, let's do it differently. But you know those radio messages are going to get played out. You know your reaction is going to get played out. And you don't go and dive bomb your teammate on the slowdown lap. I mean, come on.
I mean, if they'd hit, he should have been sent home straight away. I mean, it would have been end.
If they'd hit, he'd have been sent home and Liam would be in for Saudi.
Yeah.
Like 100%. Come on.
100%. I'm actually excited to see that you do have those guys in the wings that are so aggressive and so talented and so trained, right, with the sim work, with what they've done in the junior formula on the way up. And obviously Liam showed so well last year in those brief, races, you know the talent is waiting there. Not that the talent is not there with each of these guys. I couldn't drive like Yuki. I mean, he's, you know, on a scale, he's right up there in that top percentage. Not one of the greats, but right there to even drive one of those cars. But you know there's some good guys waiting. And I believe when you've got 20 drivers on the grid who should represent the best of the world talent, if you're not cutting it, you should be moved.
Yeah, and I think we're going to have a few that will be this year, whether it's in season or at the end of the season. And we've got an incredible cast of talent in Formula 2 this year who will be vying for seats in Formula 1. You know, you've got Ferrari junior Oli Bearman, who is very, very impressive and showed so when he did the practice sessions for Haas last year. Zane Maloney, who is a Sauber junior, just made history by winning the sprint and the feature.
I saw that
in the opening weekend of the F2 season. That's never been done before, going all the way back to the start of the GP2 series in 2005, when they first started having feature and sprint races in F1's feeder category. Never been done in the opening weekend of the season. And he's Sauber junior driver. So, you know, Zhou Guanyu and Valtteri Bottas are going to be looking over their shoulders, because this kid is coming and he's quick. And then, of course, you've got, you know, Kimi Antonelli,
the wonder kid.
Yeah, he's the next Max. Everyone's saying it. He's the next Max. He's the next Lewis. You know, whatever tag you want to put on him. It's a lot of pressure for a 17-year-old. Him and Behrmann are actually teammates this year, and their team, Prema, had an absolute nightmare. They are traditionally the target team in Formula 2. There's a brand new car, and it just seemed in that opening round, Prema just didn't get their head around the setup of the new car. Had a torrid weekend. As Maloney swept to back-to-back wins.
So, I mean, it is an exciting thing. I'm looking forward to getting into this weekend. I mean, you've got to remember that Sergio won this last year. You know, Alonso was on the podium. I mean, so many things to play for. But before we let you go, we do have to talk about it. Motorsport, while we know from Drive to Survive, while the average fan, you know, not average, I'm not calling you average, but, you know, the fan that sits at home and follows it through social media, TV and the news might not know that the Formula One paddock is actually a very small environment. It's an ecosystem where we kind of know everything that's going on. Same in sports cars, same in tennis or whatever top sport. It's not as big on the inside as it is from the outside with the people. So when things happen, like it's going on with Horner at Red Bull, there's a lot more knowledge floating around than we tend to know about. A lot of gossip. By the time you read it, there's a lot more happening. How incredibly destructive and distracting is it in the pit lane?
I don't work at Red Bull, so I can't say what it's like within the team. And we have to be very sort of careful about what we say, because I think it was a very, you know, it's a very tough weekend for all the boys and girls at Red Bull Racing who just want to go racing. I did read a very interesting article by Mark Hughes this morning, who said that he believes whatever happens as a result of what is going down at the moment, that this is the beginning of the end of the era of Red Bull's dominance in Formula One, because there's clearly a lot more to the story that is yet to play out, if we can say that. And when it does, then it will have fairly big ramifications.
You politician, you sounded.
Well, I mean,
we know
there's
where
there's,
you were.
But it's not just that, you know, there's, it's a, at the moment, it's a private matter between those involved in it. And we are not party to, you know, what has been accused, how the investigation has been done, or any of the details of that. We just don't know, and we really don't. So it's very, very difficult to comment on something before you have the full facts at your disposal. In fact, it's you know, very irresponsible to do that until you have all those facts at your disposal. So we have to sit and wait until we can talk about it properly, and then, you know, then we'll be able to. For the time being, it's as I said, for the boys and girls in the team, you know, who this incredible racing team who have gone and set these incredible records. Yeah, I think for all of them, it was a tough weekend, and they would have been overjoyed to come away with the win. But again, as Mark Hughes wrote today, it's very difficult to see a way out of this that does not now herald the beginning of, potentially the beginning of the end of this incredible period for them.
We are not privy to that information, so therefore we can only speculate on the repercussions of these situations. And I think Gerhard Berger may have knocked it on the head when he said, And he knows some things, and you know he's right in there. As things stand now, Horner is staying. Marco and Newey would leave. Max would go to Mercedes. That spells the end of a dynasty.
I think there's a lot of water got to go under a lot of bridges before we before we get there. A week ago, we were saying Kimi Antonelli was going to go to Mercedes in 2025 because Toto was so gutted that he'd missed the opportunity to sign Max back in the day. There's a long way to go. But you know the old saying, my friends, when you assume, you make an ass out of you and I.
Ooh, I like it. Hey, well, listen, predictions for this weekend? Same, but a little closer. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, I love the Jeddah Corniche circuit. It is fast, you know, blind entry, tight with the walls. You cannot make a mistake. You get some of the most scintillating one-lap performances from drivers around there in qualifying. So I'm really looking forward to qualifying, really looking forward to seeing everybody absolutely put it on the line. It's difficult to call at the moment. Of course, Red Bull are going to be fast. So I'd love to see a proper fight between Max, Checo, of course, who was so fast there last year, the Ferraris over pole position. You know, Lando thought he could have been on the front row last weekend. Mm-hmm. Fernando outdid himself with a top six start. I'm really, really looking forward to quali, and then let's see how the race plays out and whether it's, you know, Max running off into the distance again or whether Ferrari can take that fight, whether Mercedes have got over those little engine worries and can take the fight to those guys. You know, look, we've only had one race. There are still so many unknowns within the sport, so many questions yet to be answered, and we'll only start to gather our information over these races when we go to all of these different circuits. You know, Bahrain has very little in common with Saudi, has very little in common with Australia, and then we move on to the likes of, you know, Suzuka, which comes so early in the year this year. I'm really looking forward to going there and going back to China before we, you know, we head to Miami and then back to Europe. So there is so much and so many different types of circuit that we will visit before we get back to anything like that kind of normal for F1 European heartland of those traditional races. So I can't wait, mate. I'm really excited. Plus F2 in Saudi as well. F1 Academy gets its season 2 debut. Really looking forward to that, because I think the quality of the field in F1 Academy this year is amazing, particularly with Ferrari and Mercedes juniors, Maya and Dorian, they're both, you know, very, very fast. So I'm looking forward to seeing how they fare as well. And I mean, what a track for F1 Academy to have as its opening round of the season.
So demanding.
Unforgiving. Yeah.
Well, listen, mate, it's so good to talk to you. I will hopefully see you at one of the races. Definitely going to the British Grand Prix first time in like 20 years. So looking forward to it. We'll stay in touch.
Remember, they've moved the pit lane. It's not where it would be when you went last time.
So you mean I shouldn't be standing like looking around for it? To talk about the book.
Go down to Club Corner. Yeah, it's down exactly. At Club Corner.
Talk about the book, because obviously that's pretty cool.
Thank you, mate. Yeah, shameless, so it comes plug. Out. Please, thank you. Comes out this summer. It is called Grand Prix. And it is an entire history of Formula One. So it starts talking about today and what the sport is today. And then we go back all the way back to the invention of the car and pre-war racing. But then we really start in 1950. And we go through everything that happened in the 1950s, that decade. We talk about every single champion that was crowned, one champion a driver who wasn't a champion, but I thought could have been a champion. Some other drivers of note, all the great teams, one great race from the decade. And we do that for every single decade. And the reason I've written it is because there are so many new fans who are just getting into this sport. And as Stefano Domenicali, I think, said last year, one in three fans estimated now to have got into this sport in the last 5 years. So one in three F1 fans has only been watching for 5 years or less. Everyone's had their first race, but how are you supposed to catch up with 70 years of history that you never saw if you're a new fan? And my hope is this book will be a
Bible,
easy jump
a
into
Bible
the
on how to do it. I love it.
Yeah, I hope so. This is, oh, there we go. There you go.
Whoa, available for pre-order on Amazon, I presume.
It is indeed. But yes, an illustrated history. It's all illustrated. And whether you're a new fan or whether you've been watching for ages and you just like a reminder of all the stuff that went before, it's, yeah, I hope it's something that, that people will really enjoy and you can just dip in. You know, if you've never heard of who was Jim Clark or who was Denny Holm or who was Ayrton Senna, you can dip in and discover who these amazing drivers were.
Yeah, you're the best, mate. Thank you so much.
Thank you, buddy. We'll chat soon. I appreciate it.
All right, bud. Bye.
All right, mate. I look forward to it.
Well, what a great insight. Thank you very much, Will. This weekend in Jeddah, I mean, I think Will summed it up best. It's one of everyone's favorite tracks. Blindingly fast between the walls at night. Average speeds of around 250 kilometers per hour. That's like 160 or something. Wild in normal speed, miles an hour. I remember Sergio Perez did win this last year. Max Verstappen second, and it was Alonso's podium finish that, again, backing up what he had done in Bahrain the week before, that made everyone sit up and go, oh my gosh. And if you've been following Drive to Survive, you know that that became one of the key storylines. One of the things to remember is that the teams have so much learning in this very short period of time, crunching the data, millions of streams of data from what they learnt in Bahrain. Their new cars, as Will said, out on track, all that technology, all that theoretical knowledge being applied to practical reality on track. How do the cars, how do the tires respond over the stint? How is the tire deck? So many things that they've got to deal with. I mean, the overheating across the front wheels, with brake system with the Charles Leclerc car, that's gonna have to be gone. If it isn't, it's a design fault. The Mercedes engines, we know that they've had an overheating issue. That has to be dealt with going into this weekend. Is it software? Is it cooling? I don't know. We're going to, you know, some very, very smart people have to rectify that. So in many ways, the order will change. I think we're going to see, you know, some incredible things. I mean, for me, I would predict that I do think obviously Max will probably win, but I think Charles Leclerc will get pole. I think he'll get pole. And if he's on form, I want him to beat Max to the first corner. It'll make me happy. You'll hear me happy next week. So it's a lot to shoot for. So to make things interesting, it's time for JB's Plus Money Podium Pick of the Week. And this week, I am going to go with Carlos Sainz at plus 135. It means if you put $100 down, you'll win 235. I think he can do it again. I actually think it might even be better than third place. Who knows? But he's definitely trying to make his statement to the world that he is the guy that you should pick up one of the other top Formula One seats going into 2025. Well, that's it, guys. Thank you very much to Will Buxton for taking the time to join us. And of course, a huge thanks to The Win here in Las Vegas for letting me use their beautiful studio and supporting the show. And of course, to Mobile One, for the love of driving. See you next week, guys.